Navid Madavian has written a graphic memoir about the 3 years he and his wife Emily spent in a tiny cabin in a very rural part of Idaho. He's a cartoonist who contributes to The New Yorker. She's a filmmaker. And they were living in San Francisco, a life I guess you could describe as the inverse to Mackay, Idaho, and its 400 or so residents. But they went, you know, for the cheap land, the open space, grow a garden, be creative, and try and be neighborly in Trump country when you're an Iranian American, as Navid is. There's one part of the book, a sequence of panels, where Navid is helping out a neighbor, Jim. And they stop by and see John, who, like Jim, is obsessed with guns.
They start talking about guns, and I'm trying to keep up. And over coffee, suddenly the conversation turns to politics, which is something that I try as much as I can not to engage with. You know, they use the N-word, the F-word, and talk about how Trump had done more for the economy in 8 months than that raghead had done in 8 years. And I'm sitting there just flabbergasted. I'm clearly a Middle Easterner. Do I say anything? What do I do? And to this day, I'm not sure, were they talking about it because they just felt comfortable enough with me there? Was I one of the gang? Did they just not care how I might respond? I felt this distinct feeling of being a minority, of being invisible, of receding into nothingness. Then I just, for the remainder of the conversation, say nothing. There's an image of a chair that I use. Initially, there's just an outline of me, and I ask, am I invisible? And then I'm no longer in the chair. The next scene, it's me looking towards the door, feeling unsafe. Then me just being very small, and these two figures who are physically much larger than me, looming in the foreground, darkened. It's foreboding. And I'm just sort of in the distance. And then at the end, there's this cognitive dissonance where, as I'm leaving, John, who I've just met and who's just dropped these, you know, bombs, is like, you know, if you're ever in town, come on back. I just don't know how to square the conversation, the words that they were using, and this welcoming tone that he uses at the end. And I feel like that's a nice encapsulation of my encounters with many people in the town, this push and pull, where I feel pushed away and then pulled in, where they're kind to me, but then they can say these really terrible things. One of the things that I try to get across in the book is that it was complicated. Often people were very welcoming, kind, but then there were these moments that would punctuate my experience of being there in otherwise friendly conversations and encounters where I'm having a nice, normal conversation with somebody, and then there's that whiplash. You know, they ask a question like, you're not a Muslim, are you? Or they drop the N-word. And in those moments, I have the distinct feeling of being small, of being powerless, of not knowing what to say. And I've often thought about when it's late at night and I'm trying to fall asleep, I think back and I'm like, oh man, that's the zinger I should have used. That's the comeback. I should have like whipped out my tiny Quran and been like, let's pray together. But in those moments, I didn't think those things and I just kind of shrunk. I've felt a lot of shame around that, and I tried to process that in writing the book.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Navid Madavian is joining us. His book is called This Country, Searching for Home in Very Rural America. He and his wife and his daughter ended up here in Salt Lake City, and we wanted to talk to him this week about his experience in Idaho, how he wanted to capture it in the panels of a graphic memoir and how his idea for the book changed.
The initial conception of the book was going to be about my parents. My parents are from Iran. They immigrated here in the midst of the revolution in 78. They didn't know the revolution was going on. They thought that they would be able to return for my mom's birthday in October. It was June. But then they ended up not being able to return for 10 years. And so initially, I wanted to write that story, but I spoke to my friend Amy Kurzweil, who's another New Yorker cartoonist and writer, and she was like, well, where are you in this story? And I knew that I needed to incorporate myself more into it. And as I continued to work through, conceive of the project, I became a bigger figure. And then eventually my parents were kind of just, you know, pushed out of the story almost entirely, much to their annoyance. And I thought about, well, how can I best tell the story of these 3 years? And as you said, I leaned into initially this idea of focusing on nature, and nature is still a major part of
for
the
sure.
story.
Yeah.
You know, the development of my character is largely told through this budding relationship with the natural landscape. I wanted to tell it through like January to December. I'm a big fan of Aldo Leopold. He's somebody who I discovered there. He was a 20th century naturalist and conservationist. And he has this book, The Sand County Almanac. I actually start the book off with a quote from the book where he talks about the personality of land. And so I wanted to lean into that and focus each month on different flora and fauna and tell the story of our 3 years there, but sort of compressed into 1 year. Yeah. And then I think rightfully my agent and editor were like, I think people want like characters and people and like a narrative and story.
Yeah. Conflict.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I still managed to, I think, keep the spirit of that initial idea in the book by having these extended sequences of nature where it's just the character of Navid wandering in the woods, in the snow, looking at tracks, looking at bald eagles. And some of the original chapters that I pitched as part of the book proposal, which focused on, you know, there's a chapter on like gooseberries and listening to birds. Those ended up making it into the book basically as they were. But I just had to figure out how to position them within this now more traditional narrative.
But you have to, now that it's becoming, is memoir appropriate?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I mean, I think so too.
Yeah.
And one of the things you've talked about is that, so it's, you said you have to kind of create a character.
Mm-hmm.
It's you, and this is real, and this was your actual experience. Mm-hmm. But you are creating a character. What do you mean by that? I found that really
interesting. Yeah, I think anybody who were to if anybody who knows me were to read the book, they would recognize the character, the avatar of Navid as being me. But I had to think about myself as a character. Which was an interesting process, and I think it's probably the process that every memoirist has to go through, where you have to step back and think about, well, what was my growth over those 3 years? You know, like if I'm telling the story of Navid as like the hero, right? What is that journey? And so I had to think about, well, where do I start? I start as the bumbling idiot, which is sort of true to my character.
Yep.
I had to lean into that and then think about, well, what are those moments of growth?
Yeah.
What happens to this character? What are those key moments where we can see growth? And then where does the character end up? And I think that as we're living our lives, we don't generally think about it in those terms.
In a narrative, clean narrative
arc. Exactly.
Yeah.
At least I don't.
You're right.
I mean, we all do think that we are the heroes of our stories. But it was only in sitting down, thinking about what happened over those 3 years. How do I tell a story? Because it also has to be a compelling story.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, our lives are not compelling. They're just day to day. I did leave out those moments where I was like playing Legend of Zelda, you know, like the curtains drawn and it's not the romantic Idaho experience. So some of those things are left out. But I just had to think of what are those moments? What's the character's growth? And how can I tell that in a way that is true to the experience, but that's also funny and interesting?
Yeah. Why did you move to a very, very rural part of Idaho?
It's because it's romantic.
Well,
my wife, Emily, and I, we had visited Idaho on a whim the summer before. You know, we fell in love with the landscape. The Lost River Mountains are majestic. Yeah. They're beautiful. They promised freedom. We both wanted to be artists. We were living in the San Francisco area. I was a teacher. And between traffic, work, I couldn't do cartooning, which is what I wanted to do. And so we had this idea, let's buy a bunch of land, which is very cheap, not surprisingly, in rural Idaho.
It's cheap. It's beautiful.
Exactly.
There's freedom. You have what? This romantic ideal that you're unfolding, right?
Yeah, exactly. And we thought we would have time to do the things that we wanted to do. And it was right. Romantic, possibly naive. But I think that we achieved what we were looking for, although a part of it was trying to find our forever home. We did genuinely think that this would be the place that we would settle down, grow our roots, but spoiler alert, we ended up moving in the end. But I think that for those few years that we were there, we did find what we were looking for.
There's an acknowledgement section in the book where you say to Emily, your wife, basically, this is about you. Say more about that, because I think in some ways I wonder, you say it was her sense of wonder,
yeah,
her sense of adventure that may have been kind of the motivating element here. Not that you went kicking and screaming.
Sure.
I mean, clearly you went along, but it seems like she was the real sort of like, let's do this. Or is that right?
Yeah. We were both excited about the idea.
Sure.
But when she gets interested in something, she really gets interested in something. Yeah. And so she's the one who looked at properties in the area. She designed our tiny home.
Yeah.
She learned how to do that. She learned about off-the-grid living, solar panels, pumps, our wood stove, which was called a Hobbit. It's very small. Our home was 280 square feet.
Right.
She was the sort of mastermind behind all of this, and I was the, as I said, bumbling idiot who was along for the ride. And so I think even though we were both excited about going, we would not have gone had it not been for her enthusiasm, her dogged determination to be able to figure things out, her obsessiveness. When she gets into something, she really gets into it. So
what were you expecting in the way of, something was appealing about being off the grid.
Yeah.
But surely you knew that when you're heading off into the rural part of the Intermountain West, you're going to confront different political views, mm-hmm. different cultural views, all of those kinds of things. What were the expectations that you had, and how did you figure early on how you might negotiate that and manage all of that?
Again, romantic,
yeah.
Naive.
Right. There's a theme here.
Yeah. I think we understood the political dynamics.
Sure.
The district voted 90% for Trump.
Yeah.
Our first time visiting, there were the MAGA flags, the Don't Tread on Me welcome sign. So I don't think we were under the impression that we were going to be going into somewhere that was not heavily, fiercely Republican and pro-Trump. But then we're also fans of, northern exposure. And so I think there was this idea that we were going to find this, cast of kooky characters,
yeah.
and have this kooky life. But I also feel like there was that element of living off the grid, having our tiny home, having our land that was separate from the town itself. The town was 20 minutes away, and
sure.
it was very easy to just be on our property. And there were periods, particularly when I was by myself, like a month would go by before I would really see anybody, because I would just store up on stuff. I would be in the cabin doing my work, exploring. And I didn't really have to think about the complicated political dynamics that were going on in town and, America at large. So I was able to kind of isolate myself from that. But a place is not just the land. It's not just your home. It's also the people. And I think that is a major reason for our eventual leaving, because although we did develop these close friendships with people, we did find community there. At the end of the day, I do think that there was this cultural
yeah.
gap and widening political gap that I think COVID really fractured, entirely.
And made you think that we really can't
stay. So we actually left just before yeah. the pandemic. But when I would visit after that, there is a small town ethos, which I loved. I benefited from. I gave back to. But I think that on our visits during the pandemic, you know, the people who refused to wear masks, who would look at you a certain way when you wore masks, that desire to help people within your community, it didn't feel like that was there anymore, and that had become politicized.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the major elements of sort of small town rural living that I did like, that small town ethos, just didn't seem to be there anymore. And so it just it felt like we had made the right move.
How do you understand that? Whereas before, you may have had neighbors, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the encounters you have with neighbors, which is this kind of ebb and flow of, oh, they're incredibly friendly, and yet they're saying things that are wildly inappropriate, mm-hmm. or whatever. And what did you make of the fact that you sort of set aside some of those things from time to time in those early days, it seems like, because you did find things that you had in common.
Yeah.
You could relate to them.
Mm-hmm.
But something – what is it that happened during COVID, or at least during that time frame, that made people less generous? Or I don't know how you – like what do you make of what was going on? Because things did shift enough for you to figure, we don't want to live here anymore.
It was one of the things that I – That cognitive dissonance that I tried to work out while I was there and understand how people could be so kind on a one-on-one basis and then say terrible things or hold views that I felt were harmful,
yeah.
to people like me, to my family, people I cared about, people who I don't know but are still harmful to them. I think it's very easy to be kind to somebody who's in front of you, to find ways in which you are similar, things you have in common, but then these larger ideas, they can be at odds with that experience. So like in that conversation with Don, where, you know, he's using the N-word, talking about ragheads, but then welcoming me in, that's that dissonance that I tried to figure out, and I wondered, like, how can they not see,
yeah.
that the things that they're saying are harmful to a person like me? And I think that it's just that there are these ideas, these bigger ideas that are pernicious, that come from Fox News. You know, they're concerned about the wall, even though the wall is 2,000 miles away. These things that on a day-to-day basis have no bearing on the way that you interact with the people in your community.
Yeah.
But then when they come up, you somehow disassociate it from the person who you are talking to.
Mm.
And I think that probably happens on both the left and
sure.
the right, where coming in, I had an idea of what the people would be like there, sort of stereotypes. Didn't imagine I would be able to become friends with people who looked, you know, very different from me, who had views that were very different from me. But you do develop those relationships and you just don't talk about certain things, right? There was this old idea that you don't talk politics and religion.
Yeah.
But I feel like we've gotten to a place where it's hard to do that when it is hard to separate someone's politics with the effect that that politics has on people who look like you. And I still don't know if I've worked out entirely how they were able to do that. But it was nice to be able to develop relationships with people who had views who were very different from me, some that I might have found offensive or harmful. But at the end of the day, I also felt like I couldn't continue to be silent.
Mm.
You know, I just didn't talk politics, but I would like to. I would like to have those conversations. And when I did, I thought that they were fruitful.
Yeah.
And but there's only so long you can stay quiet.
Tell the story about Ruth and the bomb she sort of dropped.
Yeah, so there was the coffee shop in town was also the Coffee Bates Tackle beer shop.
Awesome.
And it's where you'd go in the morning, and it's
yeah.
where, you know, lots of the retirees would congregate. The owner of the store was a Democrat, and they would have these sort of lively but very friendly conversations about
yeah.
politics. And this one time, I'm sitting there doing some work, and I strike up a conversation with Ruth and Nolan, and we're just talking about like the weather and our experience. And she says, you should become, oh, you were a teacher. We're always in the looking for teachers. And it's a very welcoming, what feels like a very pleasant conversation. And as she's leaving, she says, can I ask you a question? And I say, sure. And she says, very matter-of-factly, you're not a Muslim, are you? And the question isn't, are you a Muslim? It's, you're not a Muslim, are you? And afterwards, she's like, oh, I'm just being nosy. And she leaves. But it's one of those moments that stayed with me because I didn't know how to respond. And in the book, I try to process that. And I have this conversation with Emily afterwards where I'm like, I wish I would have said that. I wish I would have said this. But in the moment, I just froze. And I think that I said no. And I'm not, but my parents are. And I felt like this incredible shame. And I carry that with me because I felt like in this moment, I had an opportunity to push back a little bit, to perhaps be the first Muslim that, you know, Ruth has met, to honor my parents, their experience, their heritage. And I chickened out. You know, yeah. I shrunk. I felt small. And I didn't know how to respond. And I wonder, like, if I would have said those things, what the outcome would have been. But I think in the moment, it just felt like there was that power dynamic. I was this outsider, and I was made, whether intentionally or not, to feel like an outsider.
You write that you're not a Muslim, are you? Actually means, please tell me you're not the thing I associate with your facial features.
Yeah. I think it was the first major experience of being confronted with how other people perceive me. And then I have this, I flash back to this experience of looking at a photo of my mom as a teenager for the first time and seeing her and having this experience of like foreignness. And I realize it's because her hair is black. And I've never seen my mother with black hair because she's always dyed it. And so I have this conversation after this encounter with Ruth, with my mom, where I'm like, you know, why did you dye your hair? And she says, it's because it makes me look younger. And I'm like, are you sure it's not because you're trying to assimilate? And she's like, no. But I'm like, I wonder. It is a major moment for me in my experience there because I'm confronted with being a minority, with looking different. And then, you know, what does that mean for my time here when the first thing people are going to think about me when they see me is, you know, foreigner, even though I'm not a foreigner.
That's Navid Madavian. His book is This Country, Searching for Home in Very Rural America. The book isn't just about these interactions you have. There are these sections where land is so important and these particular moments. And I wanted to talk about a few of them, because one of the things, there's this section in the book where you write about the kind of the rhythm to winter. Mm-hmm. There's this nice Wallace Stevens image and Robert McFarlane, the writer, and Walker, who's quite great. There's a quote that you mention in there. He says, we are animals, and like all animals, we leave tracks as we walk. And so there's this moment when you're encountering so much snow in rural Idaho, but that also means that sort of the magic of these tracks everywhere. And you write a lot about that, and we see the images of that. Will you talk a little bit about this part of the book and just seeing your interaction with the changing seasons and your relationship with the land? Because that seems as much a part of this book as anything else.
Yeah, I didn't want the book to be about being an Iranian-American moving. It makes like a great log line, like Trump's just been elected, I'm Middle Eastern, I moved to, you know, like, but the book is much more about that. And my experience was much more than that. And so I wanted my experience, my relationship with the landscape, with nature, to be this major theme in the book. And as I said, there are these extended sequences where it's just me, where it's me looking at, you know, the tracks, quoting naturalists, which is what I was reading at the time, trying to understand my experience of being there. We came in, we were prepared, but we were also unprepared. I did not know it could get to negative 37 degrees. Right. And in that first winter, neither of our cars would start. They were both diesel. So there was this like learning curve, but it also meant it was an opportunity to explore. And I say at the beginning of the book that when we bought the land, it was just land, but it's not just land, right? There are these animals that make themselves present through their tracks, through their calls. And we felt like it was our responsibility to learn the personality of the land. And so I did get into bird watching before it was cool. and I was able to track the seasons by, you know, the birds that, you know, When the geese came in, we knew it was spring.
Right.
But then there were also some birds that were only there for a day. And so there was just this way that our experience was enriched. Robert McFarlane has this book, The Lost Words, where he talks about the Oxford English Dictionary for Kids was getting rid of some words. And many of them had to do with nature, like acorn, and they were replacing them with words like email, which is important. But he thought, like, what a loss. Like, what is the loss to our experience when you no longer have names for things you're seeing? And he says, you just can't see them. And so I think that there was, over the course of the 3 years, I began to see things that had obviously always been there, but I just didn't have words for them. I didn't know to look for them. So the landscape just became so much richer in being there. And obviously we weren't the first ones. Like, we came in and we learned the names of things. People who live there, this is their experience. They've been there, many of them, since they were kids.
Yeah.
And so we learned from them, you know, on walks, what the names of the trees were, what the names of the birds were, what the different sort of animal scat, what animals those came from. So we did lean into the knowledge, the collective knowledge that our neighbors and friends had developed as a way of becoming real members of our community, which was not just the people, but the flora and the fauna and the landscape.
When you arrive, you say in the book that people in small towns quickly learned, always know who you are.
Yeah.
Like, who are these people? Mm-hmm. Let's go visit.
Yep.
Right? This happens to you. Jim and I think it's Angie.
Yep.
Yep. Come by. And it's a very, seems like a very benign sort of conversation. Maybe it was entirely, but then there's the moment when they ask where you're from.
Mm-hmm. Which, again, is one of those questions that, given the context, could just be a very benign question. But
yeah.
Our neighbors, they've come on to see us. They've brought wine. And one of the first questions they ask is, you know, where's your name from? Which one tells you that, you know, they've been thinking about it.
Yeah. Right.
And they, I think she thought it might be like Iraqi and he thought it might be Syrian. And I say it's Iranian. And Angie's response was, oh, well, that's okay, which I thought was such a great response. And
what does that even mean?
I don't know. And I wondered, like, what would have been the not okay
right.
Response? And then Jim almost immediately launches into this conversation about ISIS and how ISIS
yes.
is in Idaho, and another thing where I don't know how to respond. And I just nod my head and I'm like, sure, ISIS
yes.
is here. So it was this nice introduction to the place and its people because on the one hand, there was this very, you know, they brought wine. They came
yeah.
to welcome us to the neighborhood. So they're, you know, they're pulling us in and then they're saying these things that then push.
Yeah.
And so there's just that constant back and forth and trying to negotiate what do I say in these conversations when I just don't know, like, how to respond when somebody's like, ISIS is here?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, what do you think it was that was most disorienting for your neighbors, like Jim and Angie? Was it that you were a man with dark skin and an exotic-sounding, quote-unquote, name? Mm-hmm. Or sort of a phrase you put later in the book, a tiny coastal elite man, you know, who panics over nothing.
Yeah.
Like, is it that you're a city guy who doesn't, obviously right now you don't know what the hell you're doing.
Yeah.
Was it that was disorienting, or was it the color of your skin, or was it a little bit like, what was it, do you think?
Yeah, I think it was both.
Yeah.
I mean, there were the looks that went on too long, which may have been because of the complexion of my skin. And then there were the questions like, you're not a Muslim, are you? Which were definitely because of the complexion of my skin.
Yep.
But I think in some ways it was being a city person that I think was more of a concern to the people there. There's always the fear of the Californication. And we came from California
yes.
and San Francisco, no less, right? The epicenter of everything that's wrong
yeah,
with America.
This is true.
Yeah. And
people in the Intermountain West feel incredibly suspicious of people who come from California, San Francisco.
Yeah.
I'm sure, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so I think lots of the time it probably was that. They are self-reliant. They do have this vision of themselves, right? Like the cowboy. And they are cowboys, right? It's predominantly a ranching community. And so I think that, like, American mythology of self-reliance, independence, that is them. And so when you have people from the coasts, from the big cities moving in, I think that there is this suspicion of, one, are you going to try to change the place? Mm-hmm. There was that sign I describe in the book, which basically says it's in the hardware store that I come into often.
Welcome to Idaho.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's basically, if you don't like it here, then go back to wherever you came from.
Yes.
Don't try to change this place. This place is the way it is. Don't make it like that. We like it the way it is, whatever that means.
And don't drive up our real estate prices.
Exactly. And that's another thing that they're concerned about. I think that it was, that suspicion was complicated. And I think for some people, it probably was being a Middle Eastern American. And I think for others, it was being this coastal elite who's coming in order to change the place.
But then you write this in the book, which I found really interesting, which seemed like you kind of granting this, you were granting a kind of grace to Jim, for example, who was talking to you about the fact that there are ISIS here. Mm-hmm. And the, as he says, you know, the radical Muslims live among the ones who aren't so radical.
Yeah.
And you're trying to sort of make sense of that. But then you write in the book, you say, over time, you learned that Jim wasn't constantly looking for ISIS. He was just looking for wildlife.
Yeah.
Which I thought was an interesting concession to the fact that maybe he wasn't freaking out about ISIS all the time, that there is some other dimension to his personality and life. Is that right?
Yeah, I think in the same way that being an Iranian American was not the whole of my experience there, I think that these ideas that I do think come from Fox News outside, it's not the entirety of who they are as well. You know, as Jim and I would be driving around, he would just constantly be pointing out wildlife, the ducks, and whatever it is, he'd stop, pull over, and look at something. And they are, you know, complex people, and I think that these unfortunate ideas are just one element of, you know, their characters. And so I wanted to create this nuanced, complex portrait of a place that I think I had the privilege of getting to know over the course of 3 years as an outsider, but then also as somewhat of an insider, because, you know, we are not stereotypes, you know, and sometimes those stereotypes are stereotypes for a reason. But again, Jim became one of my close friends in that first year, and there were just certain things we didn't talk about. I remember we had one conversation about evolution where he didn't believe in evolution, and I tried convincing him that evolution was true, and he was like, oh, well, that explains why some of my relatives are like, they're like monkeys. And so I think, you know, we were able to have these like friendly conversations and get to know one another, and I tried as much as possible to leave those more pernicious things out of that relationship as much as I could.
There's a sequence in the book where you, and this was in the early part of your experience there, where you, it's winter, it's freezing cold, the roads are incredibly icy, you can't turn the steering wheel, you drive off the road, it's terrifying, there's a big semi there, I don't know exactly what the experience was, but there's
it
a moment...
Terrifying.
It sounds terrifying, I have to say, and it looks terrifying in the book. And you ask yourself at one point, after you sort of take a deep breath, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
How many of those moments did you have where you're like, what are we doing here?
Yeah, I think that there were a lot of those, some of which were that. So that scene is prompted by that question with Ruth, you're not a Muslim, are you? And then driving off and almost being hit by a semi. You know, what are we doing here? But, you know, we were there for 3 years. Things could be hard, like harsh winters, the exhaustion from trying to homestead and, you know, usually failing at doing it. And just being at sometimes, you know, feeling very isolated. There was a freedom to being out there. But then we also were 2 hours from the first like, quote unquote, like major city. And struggling to find community and so on. But then in that scene, you know, Josiah, this character, comes to the rescue.
Yeah.
He's a, you know,
big.
Yeah, he's a big guy, big cowboy, big rodeo buckle, big, you know, big cowboy hat.
Right.
And he helps us get our truck back on the road. And he's the sort of the first person who I'm able to befriend there and who saves us in this moment of questioning, like, you know, can we make it here? Can we find community? Can we find friends? And it's like, we can.
Yeah. He comes by with a six pack and he makes you elk kebabs.
Yeah. He asks again one of those questions, where's your family from?
Yeah.
And I worry, you know,
so
where's...
You're bracing, yes.
Exactly. I'm bracing for the worst.
Yes.
And then his follow-up question is, what's the food like there? And if there's anything that brings people together, it's food.
Sure.
And I tell him, like, you know, the food in rural Idaho, it's meat. And I was vegetarian at the time, which I didn't tell anybody. I mean, I feel like it's Muslim being in a city and being vegetarian. That's the thing. Exactly.
Yeah.
But he ends up, like, Googling Iranian food, and he's like, I want to make some for you. And he makes elk kebabs. And I remember there was a very funny question where he had texted me saying, do you have saffron? I don't think the local store is going to have saffron.
Right.
And he invites me over, and he makes elk kebabs, which I thought was just, like, what a, like, kind, welcoming, gracious thing and very tasty thing to do for me.
It's lovely, this moment in
the book. Yeah, and then it was that night we're having it. We look up, the northern lights are there, and it just feels like this is it. Maybe we can do it.
Navid Madavian, his book is This Country, Searching for Home in Very Rural America. There's a story in the book where you take this – there's this old movie theater in town, and you and your wife, who's a documentary filmmaker, have the idea of, let's refurbish this thing.
Yeah.
And you say in the book, look, we can't ranch, but so here's something we can do for the town.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to talk to you about how it actually goes, because it's an interesting experience. It's like you are like – I don't know what you had in mind, like you were going to – show Bergman films or mm-hmm. whatever, like, and there's this section in the book where you write, you know, you are, it's like you're classing up the joint. Come and eat your cultural veggies. Like,
yeah.
We're going to give you this cod liver oil, which is great culture, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't quite work out that way at all because people wanted John Wayne movies.
Yeah.
But it was, talk a little bit about this part. I think it was really interesting because once you decide to start showing John Wayne movies, some people actually do show up. I think the give and take of this story I thought was really interesting.
Yeah. So again, naive.
Yeah.
And it goes as well as you might imagine. Yeah.
It's such a noble enterprise.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. There isn't a lot to do in town. This was something that we thought we could do for the town, but also for ourselves. The movie theater had been defunct for like 10 years. Everyone was very excited when they heard that we were reopening it. The community showed up, cleaned up, helped to find the popcorn machine, the original one from the 50s, to clean,
wow.
You know, cleaned it up. And there was this outpouring of support, and it did feel like we were now, you know, known entities within the community. But then there also was this naivete we thought we could make, this art house theater, show things that we wanted to watch. And I do feel like, you know, spoiler alert, the movie theater ends up closing. And this was one of the harder chapters to write because when people read the drafts initially, they were like, you're being too hard on them. Like, there is nothing with wanting to watch the movies that you like. And I think that's something that we discovered was, one, movie theaters are a hard business, you know, in the best of situations. But then who are we to tell them this is what you should be watching?
Yeah.
I like what I like. You like what you like. And I think that there's something very beautiful about being able to find that middle ground. And I don't think we ever did find that middle ground. But we did show John Wayne. We showed films that we liked. And sometimes people showed up. Usually they didn't. But I do explore in this section the experience of that cultural divide and of seeing John Wayne within this context. I knew that I wanted to be sympathetic to the people in town. I knew I wanted to be kind, but then I also knew that there were things that I wanted to critique because it was my experience. This was my quote unquote truth. And seeing The Quiet Man, which is the first movie we showed, you know, it's a movie I've seen many times. I like John Ford. I like John Wayne. But seeing it within the context of sort of cowboy hats framing the screen of a town that felt reminiscent of this idealized Irish past in the film that masks misogyny and deeply conservative values, it just felt too much like the town itself. And they showed up, and I mentioned in the book that, you know, they saw themselves reflected back, but I didn't.
Yeah.
And I think that scene is a pivotal moment in the scene. It's one of the more humorous moments in the book, but it's also this place where we realize that maybe that cultural mm-hmm. divide is too great, and maybe there isn't a way that we can meaningfully contribute to the community.
Well, there's a moment where this is after your daughter is born.
Mm-hmm. Spoiler alert!
Another spoiler alert! And there's a whole section about that, which is sad and lovely as well. The effort that you're making to get pregnant, and you're relating mm-hmm. it also to the progression of seasons and time. And but there's this moment in the book when you see a truckload full of dead coyotes.
Mm-hmm.
And your wife says to you, it seems like this was a moment for her that was like, this is enough. Because
yeah.
she says to you, Navid, we're adults. We can live here. I'm just quoting from the book. We can live here and understand that those things aren't our culture.
Mm-hmm.
But now here's your daughter.
Yep.
And she says, you know, if you're going to raise your daughter, Elika, if you're going to raise her there, this is going to be her culture. It's going to be her tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you thought, that's what, a deal breaker. We don't, that's the thing we don't want, I guess. Is
yeah.
that right?
Yeah. One of the things I was trying to do in the book is not to make it good versus bad, right versus wrong.
Yeah.
My parents, when they first moved to the States, they moved to Oklahoma, and I wonder in the book, like, what would my life have been like had I been born
stayed
in Oklahoma? Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Would those have been my values? Would
sure.
that have been my experience? And we realize that maybe this is not the place that we want to raise our daughter. The coyotes, it's part of what's quote-unquote, what's called the Predator Derby. Our friends there say it's a East Idaho tradition where people in the community go out and they see how many coyotes they can kill and wolves when that's legal.
Yeah.
And it comes from, you know, ranchers wanting to clear, you know, coyotes who can predate on and wolves who can predate on their cattle. It's more complicated than that.
Yes.
Environmentalists, you know, argue that it's actually worse for the problem. But it's something that happens there, and it's not something that we wanted to do for our daughter, Elika. And she would also be biracial. And I talk about in the book that I was okay with those moments of alienation, with those looks that went on too long. But is that what I wanted for her? My parents gave me the opportunity to grow up in a place. I grew up in Miami that is very diverse, where I never was made to feel like a minority and different. And I didn't want my... Raising a kid is hard enough, you know, and I didn't want to impose something that felt needless and unnecessary on her.
So you moved. You came here, Salt
yeah.
Lake City. This is the big city.
This is.
You came to.
Yeah.
And what's the difference between life in a city and life there? I mean, beyond the very obvious parts of that question.
I mean, there's the good and there's the bad. There are the things that I miss about being in the countryside. I feel like cities have a way of sort of flattening time. You drive from point A to point B. You walk into a grocery store. It's always May. It's always sunny. But being in a place like rural Idaho, I say that the land operates on the body, right? There's a way that you fall into a rhythm. You track the seasons by the birds. You learn the names of the moons. And there's just this slowing effect that, you know, that you experience there that you don't experience in cities, because cities are harried and you're constantly on the move and it's always loud. And, you know, there's always people outside my window at all hours of the night. And over there, you could go a week without seeing anybody. So, I mean, I think that there is the cliche of cities being alienating, and I welcome that alienation because it means I get the restaurants, I get the movie theaters, I get to do all of the things that I want to do in cities. But I do miss the quiet and that slower pace of living and that small town ethos where if you are, you know, pull over on the side of the road, people will stop too. I remember living in the Bay Area, I was driving once and there was a person on the side of the road and their car was on its side and I'm just driving and nobody's stopping. And I'm like, how is nobody stopping? So I stop and I'm like, is this a con? Am I going to be like, are people going to jump out right now? I have my suspicions of this poor person and I helped him. But in small towns, like, you have to stop. And I do miss that element.
I wanted to ask you about the last – maybe this is giving too much away, and I don't want to. But the kind of the – before the epilogue anyway, the last page, it's just this it's the entire experience of, of the book sort of encapsulated in a few lines and one image of the cabin.
Yeah.
I think you've said at some point that you kind of wanted to give the cabin the last word.
Yeah.
Talk about this. I think this is really terrific.
Yeah. So the reference photo I used is a picture that I took of the cabin with the majestic mountains. And when I talk about Idaho, it's usually talking about the home, this 280 square foot house that I lived in that protected us from the harsh winters. And I wanted that to be the final image because we designed it, you know, we had it built. That was the land. That's where we spent the majority of the time. And the image in my mind of the place isn't the town. It's not the theater. It's not the people. It's of that house. And I just recently learned that the house was torn down. We sold it last year. You know, there's going to be a much larger house, a workshop cattle, which seems to be the, you know, more fitting with the dominant paradigm of the place. Fair enough. But it was hard to hear because we built the home. It's where we thought we would be living. And I'm glad that I made the final image of the book.
So if you ever go back, you can't go back to see the cabin.
No.
So in some ways, do you think, why would we?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we tried to go while we had the cabin. We would try to go back once every few months.
Yeah.
It's only 4.5 hours away from Salt Lake. But I don't know how much there is to return to because it would feel sort of like a graveyard, you know, the ghosts of what once was. Yeah. Mm. And so there are those friendships, many of which were friendships of circumstance, which I don't think diminishes them.
Sure.
But yeah, I don't know if there is much reason to go back. It feels like a very specific, a very special part of our lives. And I'm glad that I was able to preserve it in the book, particularly for my daughter, who was born there, who still talks about Idaho, but who won't remember it as she gets older. So this is like sort of a little a document about that time.
One of the things we were talking about earlier was that you said that in, you know, writing or, you know, drawing the book, that the character that you created made you see yourself in a new light.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that? Like, what's the Navid character that sort of reveals itself after that experience?
I think, well, one, I can draw my face really, really well at this point.
I've done it a lot.
I have. My 10,000 hours was of my face.
Right.
As I said, that initially I conceived of the book as being a story about my parents. Yeah. And while my experience was very different of that of two teenagers moving to a new country, I think in many ways I was able to appreciate their experience more, what they went through. They were two, you know, immigrant kids trying to navigate this foreign place where they stood out. You know, they didn't know the language that well. They were just trying to figure out who they were and, you know, how do I fit into this place? And I think in a lot of ways that was my experience as well. Mm-hmm. So it made me appreciate them more, but then it also helped me to reflect more on what does it mean to be an Iranian American, something that growing up in Miami, living in San Francisco, I never really had to think about. I think for many second generation Americans, your parents' culture, where they come from, is this thing that you have to sort of put up with at home and on the weekends. And you're just trying to make it as, you know, like how to be an American, being a teenager is hard enough.
Yeah.
I think being there and being confronted for the first time with what does my face say about me? What does my family's history, like how do I honor that, particularly after having a kid? I think it just helped me to connect more with my parents and with my heritage and what I wanted to do for my daughter.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Navid Madavian, his book is This Country, Searching for Home in Very Rural America. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. If you have comments about the show or ideas you want to share, you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.